This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Okay, so we almost know how bad the cuts are going to be, and we're waiting for the Brown review with bated breath, and we do indeed live in turbulent times. So what should we do? Paul's mentioned all the issues: higher fees, student support, quality and standards, student experience, research, global competitiveness, skills, economic growth, all that stuff. And I'm going to talk about that, but I also want to talk about the values that lie behind them, and I want to talk about the emotions that are going to affect how we cope. And we need to have a balanced debate in the sense that we need to recognize those values and those emotions and not just talk about those issues in a sort of an abstracted way. And I'm going to talk about the government priorities, freedom, fairness, and responsibility, to help define some of the questions that I think we need to ask ourselves and ask other people too. That was true in 1929, which was what triggered Keynes to say it, and it was true again in 2009. And we have to stop it being true for higher education in the next 5 or 10 years. And I'm going to draw on the work of the International Futures Forum and its director, Graham Lester, who wrote a pamphlet just after the credit crunch last year and the financial crisis last year, a pamphlet called Beyond Survival. And Lester says that applying conventional wisdom in uncertain times can often lead to defensiveness, destructiveness, and despair. And faced with a threat, our emotions can often shut down our critical faculties. But there is another possibility, and that possibility is growth and transformation through learning. To find that path, we have to take a wider view so that we can re-perceive how things are and how they might be. And Lester says there are 4 steps along that path. There they are. And I'll say more about each of those in a moment. But first of all, even if we try to make sense of life by looking backwards, we're being highly selective. And we might say the current financial crisis is the worst for 80 years and the structural deficit must be reduced. But we might equally say that the level of national debt is only about a quarter of what it was as a share of GDP when we actually created the welfare state. Last year, the political narrative was about reform and regulation of the banking sector and its bonuses. And some of those issues seem to have receded, and now public services are in the front line. But it's the dominant narrative that frames what people believe and how they behave. In the West, our narrative dictates public spending cuts, but there's no agreement on the details. Some governments are actually increasing spending on higher education in a deliberately counter-cyclical strategy. So the narrative leaves some important things for us ambiguous or unspecified, and it's also ephemeral. It might soon be superseded as market confidence and economic growth return, we hope. So the danger is that we make choices for higher education without thinking beyond today's dominant but ephemeral narrative. And the choices we make should reflect our values and beliefs about the long-term purposes of higher education. We have great uncertainty, but as Mark Twain said, when in doubt, do the right thing. And futurology tells us that in an uncertain world, you must be clear above all about your values and your beliefs. One of our core beliefs, certainly one of mine, is the desirability of diversity in higher education. So it might be difficult to find common ground, but I'm going to try. Hefke Chief Executive Alan Langlands told UUK in March that these were the crunch issues that ought to be dealt with. Different institutions are going to make different choices about those issues, but no one should choose without a clear idea about their values and their purposes, and we can't have a sensible discussion about any of this without acknowledging we may have bigger worries, like the survival of our institutions. So let's just go back to those 4 steps to go beyond survival. At the moment, short-term survival is being framed within institutions as a matter of income generation, efficiency gains, and restructuring. And in the longer term, it's being framed as protecting higher education funding, probably through higher fees. If there is a shift towards more private funding through that, we should expect greater accountability to students, but we should also expect more freedom from regulation as part of the deal. Higher fees also raise issues about fairness, and fairness is rightly presented as an issue of access for underprivileged groups. But we do need to confront some uncomfortable facts. One is that our system of student support is already 25% more expensive than the OECD average, and higher education spending is socially regressive. To justify that, we need to focus much less on the graduate premium and much more on the wider social benefits of higher education. Unfortunately, in recent times, the big issue for politicians has been individual benefits and the relatively small numbers of working class people admitted to elite universities. And that mindset and that attitude has devalued the good educational experience which so many more students from underrepresented groups get in the rest of higher education. So the obsession with the elite is itself unfair. And the most effective way to widen access, as we know, is to expand the system. Standing still or contracting will certainly damage participation. It will be very unfair to those underrepresented groups. So to exercise responsibility, government and institutions need to take a broader view of the higher education system as a whole. And I think that's perhaps what David Willetts meant in those rather opaque comments at Oxford Brookes about external London University-style expansion of higher education places. So we need to think differently about the whole of higher education, including HE and FE, if we want to be fair and responsible. And as part of the rethinking, we must recognise that the first rule of survival is abandon the hope of rescue. We shouldn't do what's called bending the map, imposing existing patterns on new information. We need to keep our emotions and reason in balance so that we can make new sense of our situation. And for that, we need insight. In particular, we need to be prepared for unpredictable and disruptive change. Salvation will not be found in a strategic plan with 7 major priorities and 16 key performance indicators tuned to league tables and action plans for every department cascading from the strategic priorities. Those things might be necessary, but what comes first is a clear sense of direction. And what comes second is acceptance that we're unlikely to end up where we aim for. In turbulent times, some people batten down the hatches, opting for no change. Some people innovate for first-order change within the existing framework. But we also need second-order change from people who are ready to invest in the future rather than reinvent the past. And our pioneering should be guided by our own insight into what freedom, fairness, and responsibility should mean for the kind of higher education we believe in. For insight, I draw on a multidisciplinary research program started in 2002 by Howard Gardner and his colleague psychologists at Stanford and Claremont, called A Project on Good Work. Good work is not just about excellence. It's equally about ethics. And perhaps we can agree within higher education on the need to encourage good work in those terms. Perhaps we can also agree on our common interest in the free exploration of ideas, the pursuit of knowledge, the intellectual and human development of the individual, and economic and social transformation through higher education. Doing the right thing is not just about excellence, not just about world-class research, and not just about improving the skills base for global competitiveness. It's also about the ethics and the consequences of doing those things. How ethical and fair are our policies, for example, for international staff and student recruitment? If we strip developing countries of their best academic talent, is that responsible behavior by universities that call themselves global? We need to reflect on questions like that if we want to emerge from the cuts with our credibility intact. So how do we promote good work in higher education over the next 5 years? As well as insight, we need perseverance. Elsewhere in the world, in the higher education world, there are other narratives and there are other priorities. Simon Marginson at Melbourne has identified what he calls 5 new tensions, and those offer us a spectrum on which to locate our own institutions. Many will want to be somewhere near the middle, balancing those tensions. Most universities want to be global and national and local. We teach large numbers of students and we claim to do world-class research. We say that British higher education has the same high standards for first degrees across the sector, while at the same time proclaiming the sector's diversity. And we bridge East and West through global partnerships and overseas campuses. wherever we position ourselves, we need to persevere with that choice. And for perseverance, we also need hope. Jonathan Lear at Chicago has a nice book which he wrote in 2006 called Radical Hope, Ethics in the Face of Cultural Devastation. It's not about higher education. It's about how the leaders of the Crow Nation of Native Americans coped with the collapse of their culture when they were confined to reservations. And higher education may or may not be in such a dire situation over the next 5 years, but we have to recognize, like the Crow Nation, that our values are tested when our way of life is threatened. And where do we find our moral compass? And what do we call it now? In responding to the current challenge, too many people in higher education have resorted to scaremongering and special pleading. And just look at Michael Arthur's extraordinary statements on behalf of the Russell Group, special pleading that we can only afford 25 research-intensive universities, and then saying that the end of civilization is nigh unless we protect them. We need to find instead the kind of radical hope that Jonathan Lear talks about to keep up with changing circumstances and to keep our academic and our intellectual culture alive. In facing uncertainty, we need to use the kind of academic analysis we apply within our disciplines, but too rarely to ourselves. We need to see the big issues from a broader perspective. We have some good examples to follow. In the fees debate, Nick Barr at LSE has reperceived student loans. He says loan repayment is not like debt, it's more like income tax or national insurance. And I think the NUS has also engaged very responsibly with the debate in the position it's taken on graduate contributions. The debate about quality and standards has been distorted by tabloid journalism and populist politics, for example, in last year's Select Committee report. And QAA has been forced to steer a course between the various expectations of all the stakeholders in a way that Roger Brown has recently described as limited, incremental, and frankly muddled. To reperceive these problems, we should argue for more freedom from regulation, a trust dividend from those reductions in public spending. For government to spend less and at the same time to increase regulation would be unfair, and it would diminish freedom and responsibility in higher education. In terms of research, we need to go beyond arguments about concentration and protecting the world-class science base, which is code for no change, please. Our diverse sector preserves its narrow reputational range, partly by recognizing that excellent research can go on in many places. And research protects intellectual vitality, provides a crucial part of the psychological contract for many higher education staff. The concentration lobby is unfair and irresponsible if it ignores those issues. In terms of skills and global competitiveness, the narrative oversimplifies what higher education can do. Linear attempts at skills development often fail, as with the training of doctors, teachers, nurses, and more. On the other hand, a higher education sector, which is free to develop the courses it values, which students want, will meet skill needs not even imagined when the courses are designed. And website design is a classic recent example. So we don't just need freedom to do blue skies research, we need freedom for blue skies course development as well. But too many people in higher education play to the gallery. And the gallery thinks the Leach report demands a blueprint for teaching, so we can engineer graduates to fit the needs of the economy. Not so. What the higher education sector can do, given the freedom to respond to academic and student demand, is prepare a mass student population for the uncertain needs of the future economy. But we collude in sustaining a narrative in which it's okay to debate research assessment and the iniquity of impact measures, but somehow not okay to object to endless performance measurement, quality audits, and student satisfaction surveys, which imply that teaching is a routine activity with programmable results, while research is the opposite. We need to find a better compromise between those two inaccurate stereotypes. If we fail to do that, it's not fair to most students and most institutions. It inhibits their freedom in ways which make them less effective, and it diminishes their social responsibility. There's still a place for what Graham Lester calls social acupuncture, highly focused interventions, but large-scale blueprints don't work. What will work is expanding higher education through institutions free to plan according to their views of the future and with values which guarantee they will use that freedom responsibly. We need to reimagine the future in ways which acknowledge the integrity of our sector and the integrity of our academic practice. The great majority of students have a good experience. Most of them get that good experience in institutions which do little or no research. On the one hand, we accept that and argue there are high standards everywhere. And on the other hand, we reinforce an excessively narrow idea of what good higher education means. League tables are hard to resist in every sense, but we must in future do better than just collude with league tables that define research intensiveness as ideal for deciding which courses are best for undergraduates. We need to reimagine what we mean by good work and think of academic practice as an integrated whole, not artificially divided into research, teaching, third stream and public service activities. The kind of league table that John O'Leary invented for the Times isn't fair to students or to institutions, and it isn't socially responsible. So what should higher education be doing in our changing environment? We need to change how we think and how other people think about higher education. Higher education is an easy target for cuts because we have a narrative dominated by concerns about quality, standards, value for money, dumbing down, and the dilution of research excellence. And much of that narrative is our own fault for pursuing self-interest instead of the greater good of the whole sector. We need to remake the narrative so that it can be dominated by an appreciation of higher education as a public good, the social and economic transformation it supports, and the values it embodies of open-minded inquiry, learning, and personal growth. To get there, we should follow the path of survival, insight, perseverance, and hope. We should have in mind the need to protect and promote good work, higher education which is not only excellent, but also ethical. We need to rethink what fairness means in a diverse sector on a non-level playing field. We should think about how to be fair not only to ourselves and our current students, but also to those who are underrepresented or not represented at all in higher education. And that includes people in global communities affected by the choices we make. We should think about the kinds of freedom which are most important for good work in higher education. Academic freedom needs to be reimagined as a means of enabling effective teaching as well as research, and recognized as a privilege that comes at the price of enhanced social responsibility for individuals and for institutions. We should recognize our responsibility for protecting the whole sector from FE to Oxbridge, rather than trampling the others in a rush for the lifeboats. And if we can do all that, we'll be entitled to expect some kind of dividend from all the spending cuts, a trust dividend which really reduces regulation and micromanagement, and a governance dividend that strengthens institutions' ability to pursue their own diverse visions of the future in an excellent and ethical higher education sector. Thank you.